Williston. They all agree. Statement of contracts and restatement second. Classify negotiable instruments, including checks, to be contracts. So when the court below held that a check was not a contract, and that a drawer's liability purely statutory, it seemed to me that either the overwhelming authority was wrong, or the definition of contract.
Would it say it's not a contract, or only that it's governed by statute?
Excuse me?
It was a decision below that it states specifically that this is not a contract. I don't think that's what it said. I think it said it's governed by this statute.
It said it was statutory liability, and that it wasn't a contract for purposes of Section 38.
And it's not.
I would have to disagree with that, Justice.
Why is that?
Because a check and a
understand the check could be a contract, but under the statute, how do you prevail?
The statute itself, attorney fees, but the cases for an oral or written contract. Now, contract is not the same thing as a cause of action for breach of contract. I submit that they're different. A contract is a broader term. A contract is a promise which the law will enforce, and it can describe a number of different causes of action. Breach of contract is one. Because all negotiable instruments are formal contracts. The vast number of authorities would agree that a check defined within the statute.
Is a $100 bill a contract?
Well, Article 3 excludes money. So in that sense, no. Negotiable instruments have been deemed as formal contracts by virtue of their form. They're formed in accordance with 3104. And the rules which determine them to be a contract include them being payable to order or bear, signed by the maker or drawer, in a fixed amount, payable on demand.
Would the Court of Appeals decision basically make these types of lawsuits just almost impossible or very impractical?
Absolutely.
Want to comment on that?
As I understand the purpose for Section 38, why Section 38 was amended to include suits for a contract, one of the reasons was because there was access to the courthouse for smaller cases. The smaller cases, no one could afford an attorney or pay an attorney to prosecute a smaller suit because the attorney fees would outweigh the award.
But you do have recourse to a criminal action, right?
I mean, I'm sorry?
The courthouse is open to go through a criminal proceeding.
Yes. Criminal court would be a different situation because.
But doesn't that allow?
Well, not every dishonored check case is a criminal case. If fraud is involved, say, or some sort of hiding is happening, possibly there's a criminal action. But again, that's a higher standard. It's a different standard of proof.
Counsel. I wanted to ask you about the brief that was filed by opposing counsel, and they discuss financial instruments. Talks about letters of credit under 5.11, I think it says, and how the legislature specifically provided for the recovery of attorney's fees in the context of a letter of credit that was dishonored. And the legislature did not do so in the context of financial instruments checks. Would you respond to that argument?
Yes, I would say that, first of all, a letter of credit under Article 5 is a different animal than an instrument under Article 3.
Are they both financial instruments?
They are both financial instruments, but by virtue of them being governed by a different article, the issue isn't whether a letter of credit is a contract. It's, in this case, whether or not a check is a contract. And I would say that it's a contract not only because of all the authorities saying that it's a contract. The UCC defines it as a contract.
But the UCC also has a very comprehensive risk allocation scheme. And if we're looking at these provisions, why wouldn't the legislature provide for attorney's fees in the context of the check?
Well, the comprehensive legislative scheme applies when you're talking about issues of fraud or forgery or conversion, issues which involve torts primarily. This is a case where the drawer has issued a check and then failed to pay it, failed to honor his drawer's obligation. Now, the reason it's not a completely statutory obligation is because he's signed the check. He's voluntarily assented to governance by Article 3. He's committed himself to pay on the instrument if it should be dishonored.
Was there an express promise, though, between where this check ended up?
Well, an express promise in that a check is a negotiable instrument, and everybody recognizes a check as being a payment device. It's an express promise because when one receives a check, they know what they're getting, and they know it's a negotiable instrument, and they know it's a promise, an unconditional promise of payment.
Amakai argues that we should overturn the timeout grocery and its progeny, and that this impacts the cash checking business. Why should we even be concerned about that?
Well, for the first reason would be to be in line with the rest of the jurisdictions. The cross jurisdictions, when this issue has come up, be it for matters of venue or matters of any other reason that a termination on the nature of an instrument has arisen, whether a check is a contract generally is determined to be a contract. As it stands now, to be a completely statutory obligation it's out of line with the rest of the jurisdictions. It's against the treatise material. It's against 140 years of history in Texas jurisprudence.
I agree with you. It's a contract, but I don't see where in the statute that provides for attorney's fees. And Amakai says that we should be concerned about that because it would prohibit perhaps people that don't have checking accounts, traditional checking accounts, to negotiate checks. Why should we be concerned with that? That seems like a policy issue.
Well, we should be concerned about it because the vast number of transactions that occur in the state of Texas won't only affect check cashing companies and those who cash checks, but those who take checks as part of their ongoing businesses. As it stands, whoever receives a check from a payee won't have the right to collect that check against the drawer if the amount of the check if the attorney fees outweigh the amount of the check.
Is your recovery rule absolute no matter what the amount of the check, no matter what the amount of the attorney's fees?
I don't understand the question.
and you go into a hardware store and buy a couple of screws, you pay for it with the check, costs you a dollar. The hardware and check bounce. The hardware store is pretty tenacious.
Well,
and they go after you, but their fees really start racking up. So no matter the amount of the check, however small, and no matter the amount of the attorney's fees, however large, you would say recovery is unlimited.
Well, the beauty of the attorney fee statute is that to recover attorney fees under Chapter 38, notice, 30-day notice, and no tender within those 30 days has to take place before liability attaches. And I would say to give a potential defendant fair warning of a suit that may be coming, and then him tendering payment, there won't be a suit at all. I think that's the reason that the statute is
written. But if there is a suit, you would say the sky's the limit in terms of attorney's fees, no matter what the underlying transaction was worth.
Well, it's not necessarily about the amount. It's about the promise. It's about the promise of payment. The reason we enforce contracts is, you know, it's promises ought to be kept. It's a societal principle that we've built economy on. Now, whether or not you're speaking of would attorney fees eventually outweigh some magical amount to make this unreasonable, again, I would go back to the tender of payment rule, that if no tender is made, then the defendant is acting at his peril. It's about the promise, not the amount.
Your argument would also apply to electronic transactions if it were, you know, an electronic check sent, or I don't know, debit cards, or other forms of electronic commerce.
No, Your Honor, the electronic payments and such wouldn't qualify as formal contracts. The formal contracts must be written; they must be on paper.
But there's no real difference. So, I mean, I can pay right now, you know, go through my bank account and pay by check, or I can write one out. If I write one out, then there's this, the possibility of fees for dishonor occurs, but not if I were to send one electronically. And is there a good reason for the difference?
Well, there's more fraud involved, there's more assent in a written transaction in which a check is created. In a wire transaction, you have a bank as an intermediary. You don't do the transaction yourself, or if you do, you're not creating a document that represents a formal contract, I would say.
Well, when you...
Justice Guzman?
Please. Oh, well, you spoke about formal contracts having to be written, but your contract can be oral. What you actually mean is, I guess, to define the contours of this contract, we look to the statute.
Well, no, ma'am.
Because a contract can be oral.
Yes, Your Honor. But there's two kinds of contracts, two ways to classify contracts historically, according to Corbin and Williston. One is the formal method. The other is the informal method.
The statute make this one formal?
I would say the statute doesn't specify, as long as it's a contract, as long as it's a promise that's enforceable by the courts, by the law. That's what a contract is, according to the legislative history and 20 years of case law.
Was payment on this check stopped?
I'm not sure. The record doesn't say, and we never found out from the defendant why the check was dishonored. It was return, refer to maker. Usually in that case, there is a stop payment, but to date, we've not had a defense offered as to why the check was unpaid.
Justice Wainwright.
I'm curious about the distinction you drew between payment by written check and payment by electronic funds transfer. Maybe that's where you can start on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Alexander will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, I'd like to go straight to Justice Guzman's questions regarding upsetting the plan of the UCC. I think that the case that should centrally guide this court's decision in this case is the 2004 decision in Southwest Bank versus Information Support Concepts, which, like this case, involved a claim under Article 3 of the UCC. This court described the UCC as a comprehensive and carefully considered allocation of responsibility, a carefully allocated liability scheme, a carefully balanced liability provisions. And this court ultimately concluded that importing Chapter 33, a general statute, proportionate responsibility, into the UCC and applying it to the UCC would ignore the UCC itself and thwart its underlying purpose. Exactly the same thing would occur here if this court were to import Chapter 38 regarding recovery of attorney's fees, general provisions, into the UCC. I've got a little handout to assist my argument. If you'll go to tab 2, what you'll see is section 3.414, which is the governing statute. If you look at clerk's record page 8, you'll see that this is a claim under this statute. This is the way in which one who is a mere endorsee is able to recover on a check not made payable to the endorsee. What you'll see is this is a comprehensive scheme that allows that type of recovery, makes no provision for attorney's fees. Now let's turn to tab 3. Tab 2 dealt with suits on a dishonored check. Tab 3 deals with suits on a dishonored letter of credit, both financial instruments. Highlighted in yellow are all the rights and obligations provisions similar to what you find with respect to the 3.414, but down here in pink, there is a provision for attorney's fees, and I want to spend some time talking about it. Reasonable attorney's fees and other expenses of litigation may be awarded to the prevailing party in this type of a suit. Now, what this reflects is a very nuanced decision by the legislature, and let me explain why. In 1995, when the legislature adopted revised Article 3, the uniform proposal had this provision, but with the word must. It made the provision of attorney's fees mandatory. The Texas legislature, based upon the recommendation by the committee that was studying this, say it should not be mandatory. We think it should be discretionary. The legislature adopted that and inserted the word may. Some other states use may, most use must, some use shall. But once again, what this demonstrates, it's a matter of legislative prerogative under the UCC, this carefully balanced scheme, whether or not we give attorney's fees. There are three different provisions within the UCC that allow for attorney's fees. In addition to this one, 5.11, let me cite you a couple more. 3.305. 7.601. These are areas in which, as part of this carefully balanced scheme, the legislature says, here we will allow for attorneys.
So we will join a majority trend on this, or would we be with the major treatises and academics in interpreting it the way you say, or would we be in a minority situation?
You would be absolutely in the majority. And let me go further with respect to that. Absolutely, in fact, uniformly in the majority. What other states have done, if you'll turn to tab 4, it is a matter of legislative prerogative to grant attorney's fees for a suit on a dishonored check. Our research has uncovered 11 states that have done that, and they're summarized here. Now, what's interesting about each of these provisions, though, is that they are very nuanced, and they differ in certain respects. Go to tab 5. Here's an example of one, and I think it's important to discuss it here. This is Oregon's. Oregon, like Texas, has the UCC, and its provisions regarding, 3.414 of the UCC in Oregon is the same as we have. It makes no provision for recovery of attorney's fees on a dishonored check. But Oregon, as a matter of legislative prerogative, has said, we are going to allow for a recovery of attorney's fees on a dishonored check, although in certain narrowly circumscribed circumstances.
and it's down here at the bottom in pink. When it's a situation where the drawer of the check has insufficient funds, or has no account with a bank, or stops payment on the check without good cause. In other words, it's dealing with bad check situations. Not our case.
There has been a lot of criticism of Time Out Grocery, and I'm sort of interjecting this in there, because I think you stated in response to the Chief Justice question that we would be in the majority, and he asked about what the professors, for lack of a better word, and they have been very critical of Time Out Grocery, and so can you respond to that
yeah,
criticism?
Yeah, I think that the criticism is correct as far as it goes. And that's because they've been narrowly focused on the question is a check a contract? And I think that much of the briefing previously filed in this case, there's been a battle on that point. Is a check a contract? I think that one would have to concede that a check is a contract. And so the criticism is fine as far as it goes. But let me go further and say and explain how this court dealt with a similar argument in Southwest Bank. The dispute in that case, threshold dispute, was, does Chapter 33 apply? Well, that it only applies if you have a tort. And so the parties in that case were involved in this wrestling match as to whether UCC provision on conversion was a tort. How did this court deal with that? Footnote 6, the court says, let's assume it is. I think that this court could perform a similar analysis here. You can get involved in a lot of wrangling as to whether a check is a contract. And I will say this.
You concede a check is a contract.
I concede that it is a formal contract as stated by all of these treatises out there. Now, do I think that that a claim on a check is falls within 38, Chapter 38? No. I don't think that we have a claim on a contract, but I think that this court, as it did in Southwest Bank, would say, well, that's an interesting academic question, but you know what? Let's assume it is. Let's assume that Chapter 38 would otherwise apply. Nonetheless, because what you're trying to do is import it into the UCC, we do not give effect to it, because doing so would thwart the underlying purpose of the UCC. That is what this court ultimately concluded in Southwest Bank. Now, having said that, let me cite the court to two other cases that you should look at. One is Medical Center.
Medical City?
Thank you.
Yeah, that seems to contradict your argument.
And, it contradicts my argument because that's also a UCC case.
Which
but here's the distinction.
Attorney's fees on under Chapter 38.
Exactly. So why does my argument make sense in the teeth of Medical City? Here's why. And I'm not being flip. This is the reason why. It's because that's an Article 2 case. Okay, the case you need to look at, decided 2 months after Medical City, is JCW Electronics, 257 Southwest 3rd, 701. Okay, that was a case, another case, in which the UC, the proportionate responsibility statute, was trying to be imported into the UCC, well, into the UCC. And in that case, the court says it can be done. Why? Unlike UCC Article 3, the court concluded, Article 2 does not undertake a comprehensive fault scheme. Concurring opinion by Chief Justice Jefferson, who was the author of Medical City 2 months earlier, says Chapter the statute's provisions, that is the UCC section 2.715, stand in contrast to the comprehensive legislative fault scheme singularly applicable to claims involving negotiable instruments in revised Article 3. Chapter 33's application here would not, therefore, ignore the UCC itself and thwart its underlying purpose. In other words, this court has drawn, correctly, a sharp distinction between Article 2 And Article 3, why? Well, if we go to tab 6, for this is the express warranty that was at issue in Medical City.
Within the four corners of
that document, you've got everything you need to sue. You've got promises made by a seller to a buyer. The obligations are all spelled out. You don't need Article 3 to provide you remedies. Now let's go to tab 1. This is the check. This is the supposed contract at issue here. Now again, I'm conceding that it's a formal contract, but where, pray tell, in this, does it say that Half Price Checks gets to sue the drawer of the check?
Well, I guess you're alluding to this express promise or this promise, but you know, in this very mobile financial markets, and why does that matter? I mean, you know, checks are endorsed over and you're the holder of something and you weren't the original payee. Why is that so significant?
Well, it's only, see, I mean, I'm not, once again, I think my point here is to sue on a check. To sue on a check, you have to go through section 3.414. And that's why when you look at page 8 of the clerk's record, which is the original petition, they cite 3.414. That is what makes it clear that a mere endorsee can make the claim.
Mr.
Yes.
I'm sorry, you finished answering that question?
I'm sorry?
Are you finished there?
Yes.
Mr. Alexander, what would their remedy be then? What would their remedy be?
In what?
In the situation where the check was presented, there are no funds, what are they to do?
It would be currently the recover of a $35 fee, which may be applicable by statute, but not attorney's fees. Now, getting back to Justice Lehrman's question, and I think it's a good one, does that make sense? I mean, how is that the people are ever going to sue on a check? Personally, I'm sympathetic to that argument. Let's go back to tab 6. I'm sympathetic to that argument to a certain point. I think that the Oregon statute is as good an example of any of one that the Texas legislature might be persuaded to adopt. But importantly here, the Oregon statute talks about prevailing party. We just had another argument about prevailing party. Well, let's think about that. Let's go back to the check. This happens often. My client is an automobile insurance company. This check was to pay off the repair of a vehicle. Okay, one of the payees is DBD Motors. Why? Because under Chapter 61 of the property code, the lien holder has a mortgage on the vehicle. And so you have to have the check not just go to the insured, but also to the lien holder. And you don't want to have situations where someone forges that signature so that they can go to Walmart and get the flat screen TV instead of repairing the car. And so let's say that my client has a concern that there is a forgery. Well, the problem with their argument, it's a one-way street. It's a no-risk proposition. That is to say, the plaintiff can sue, and if they can persuade a JP court, and that's where these are litigated, that it's not a forgery, they get attorney's fees. What about my client? What about my client who is legitimately contested that this is a forgery? If he wins, if my client wins, do they get attorney's fees? No. Now, if we have the Oregon statute, yes, prevailing party. So I'm sympathetic to the argument. I think that, again, 11 states have been sympathetic to the argument. But they do it under carefully nuanced schemes. They say, some say prevailing party, others are unilateral, plaintiffs only, but they're narrowly circumscribed.
Let me take you back to section 5.111.
Okay.
And paragraph E, and you say that the Texas changed must to May.
Correct.
What does May mean in that circumstance? What would guide May?
The commentary doesn't really fully flesh that out, other than to point out that it is a departure, that the uniform scheme was must, but that those on the committee that were proposing the change felt that courts should have discretion. And I think it's really dealing with situations where a court goes, okay, look, in this situation, it seems like there, you know, whatever extenuating circumstances makes me feel like there should not be an award of attorney's fees. In all of, under the uniform scheme, and to show truly how nuanced this is, if you really drill down into it, the must language in attorney's fees came about among the big group, I mean the group that was ALI or whoever does these things, as a trade-off. The initial proposal being made was that there be an award of consequential damages. Well, that flipped out the bank. So they're going, you know, what? How is that cabined in? Let's not do that. As a trade-off, why don't we say there can be attorney's fees that must be awarded to the prevailing party? So there was a debate even in a nationwide scheme. Texas went, we're uncomfortable. It's more like, I would assume would be more like the situation with a declaratory judgment. That is, you know, we all know that in the award of attorney's fees and declaratory judgments, it's within the discretion of the court. So I think, Justice Heck, that they're really addressing that type of concern.
The argument might be made just in the abstract, without all that history, I don't know if a letter of credit is a contract or not, and so we'll put in here that you can recover attorney fees to make clear that it is, and therefore you can get attorney fees like you could under any other contract. But you think the history doesn't bear that out?
I don't think it does. No, I don't. I mean, I think that, and I hear that argument, but, you know, essentially the argument being made over here is if you have anything that's like a whiff of a contract, then you get attorney's fees. And when you look at letters of credit, they are grounded in a series of contracts. And so I think that that would be parsing the legislature's intent a little too cleverly.
One of the concerns of the amicus brief is that the check cashing businesses do serve a segment of Texans who don't have access to traditional banking, and that, I guess, for 140 years of precedent, they were able to take these checks and, in the event they were dishonored, pursue some remedy. I guess your response would be, go to the legislature?
Yes. That's my response. And again, I mean, I'm sympathetic to it. But who cares what I think? I'm not the legislature. Again, I mean, I think that a good case, back to Justice Lehrman's question, can be made that on claims, legitimate claims of this type, there should be an award of attorney's fees, but maybe with caps. Some states cap them. I mean, there are so many questions. This is so policy laden. Do we have caps on the attorney's fees? Do we allow it in suits outside the insufficient funds, or I don't have an account where I'm just writing hot checks? Should it be prevailing party, or should it be, you know, just the plaintiff?
Counsel,
yes.
On your statutes listed here under tab 4,
yeah.
Are there any decisions in those states comparatively similar to the one we're faced with here, where you have a statute that says you can recover attorney's fees on a oral or written contract vis-a-vis the UCC?
I would like to tell you that the answer to that is yes, but I don't think it is.
So we have a body of opinion in law and treatises that say a check's a contract, and you don't disagree with that. We have a statute that says recover attorney's fees on an oral or written contract, and then we have the UCC that has specific provisions.
Right.
We're the first ones that are going to blend these provisions in this case?
I think so.
To your knowledge?
To my knowledge. I mean, I don't know of any other state that, at least on this list, that has the situation of the UCC and a chapter similar to 38. Now, having said that, does that mean that you're without any guidance? And I say the answer is no. I mean, I think that if you look at the principles that are articulated in Southwest Bank, JCW, and I say implicitly in Medical City, because Medical City did not directly address the UCC collision. But I think that the principles that are articulated just in those three cases give you the answer. But back to your question, are these states similar in the same to Texas? I think the answer is no.
Would you look at that and maybe follow up with a supplemental
brief? We've looked at it enough that I'm satisfied.
When you say you think the answer is no, you're comfortable that the answer is no.
And let me do this. Assume the answer is no unless we tell you otherwise.
Some period of time?
Oh, yeah.
Week. How long?
1 week. Okay. 1 week. If you don't, we will write within a week and answer your question.
Thank you.
And it'll probably be a yes or no.
It's very wise.
A yes
question.
Or no, especially.
Thank you, Counselor.
Justice Wainwright, I apologize. Could you repeat your question?
Yes, and responding to the Chief's question about whether attorney's fees should be awardable to the prevailing party when the payment is through an electronic transaction,
yes,
instead of a handwritten check, you said the distinction is there's more consent, more assent with a handwritten check. I don't understand that. And what's the implications of allowing attorney's fees to follow thousands, millions, billions of electronic transactions?
I apologize, Your Honor. I can't speak to electronic transactions. I don't know enough about them to make judgment. What I do know is checks, handwritten checks that are governed by Article 3 and the formal characteristics that require a signature and an unconditional promise to pay and payable to order or bearer, signed by the maker or drawer, makes them contracts effective upon first delivery. It's a long-standing rule in the law in classifying contracts as formal contracts, as opposed to informal contracts, where of course the agreement of the parties is more important than the formal characteristics.
Thanks, Counsel. I appreciate your candor. What about the argument from respondent that the UCC has already decided this question? It's a fairly complex allocations of risks and balances, costs as well as fees, and the legislature has already decided that here.
I would disagree, Justice Wainwright, because the carefully allocated liability scheme argument is right on point with issues regarding tort, with issues regarding fraud, with issues regarding forgery, late return of an item, with issues regarding things that come up in banking situations that aren't contracted for. In this case, we don't have any of that. What we have is somebody who's issued a check, made a promise to pay it, but didn't pay it. I must say about Medical City that this court went a long way, I thought, to explain what we should look at when we're attempting to see if Chapter 38 applies to a cause of action within the UCC. And I believe what it said was that if the UCC, if an action doesn't speak one way or the other to attorney's fees, and it is a contract issue that speaks to liability, that the UCC can be supplemented by a law such as this. And I think that's the
respondent
situation.
Would agree for Article 2, but Article 2 is different. What do you say?
I say, in what way? Because I think the liability in that case is very similar to the liability in this case when you're not talking about unforeseen events which would affect the straightforward liability on a contract.
Well, in that case, in Article 2, the legislature determined to give an attorney's fee remedy, but not in Article 3. Why do you suppose?
I'm sorry, in Article 2 they did?
Well, under the letter of credit question. I mean, that's
Article
clearly...
Article 5.
I'm sorry, Article 5. Letter of credit context, which is clearly a contractual promise to pay as well. And there is an inclusion of an attorney fee remedy, but they didn't decide to put one in Article 3. So why do you think that is?
Well, I can say that over the years, the the courts, the appellate courts have ruled that the checks, including cashier's checks, notes, they all have been awarded attorney's fees, and they're governed under Article 3 as negotiable instruments. The award of attorney fees could have indicated to them that maybe they needed to put in a special provision like in Article 5, but they haven't done that. So either they're okay with that, or Article 5's a different animal.
So we should ignore that distinction there?
Well, I think it's a different question. I think whether or not a negotiable instrument in this case is worthy of an attorney fee is more centrally the issue. I think I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
Ayes.